strangers. All the news at home you read, more about the war and the bloody changes. Oh, will you take me as I am? Will you take me as I am? The lights down there, that's where we'll land. I saw a falling star burn up above the Las Vegas sand. It wasn't the one that you gave to me that night down south between the trailers.
All right, good morning, Mission District. My name is Julian Mark, and I'm here with our columnist and guest editor, Joe Eskenazi. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Julian.
You are listening to Listen Local.
That's a clever name.
Isn't it? We just kind of talk about the news on this show.
Good, because I can talk about the news.
Well, I know you can.
I'm qualified.
So, Joe, we wrote a story earlier this week about the city's oldest, quote, air quotes, oldest house going up for sale, recently going up for sale. But, Joe, you you wrote the story and then you decided to look a little further. Is that right?
That's pretty much what happened. Now, in San Francisco, I love it. I was born here. Don't get me wrong. But we don't have permanent history in the same way as East Coast America or, for that matter, Europe. Not to say there weren't people here, but because of impermanence of building and because of, genocide, they didn't leave traces as we see elsewhere in the world. So this particular house, which was built in perhaps 1855, perhaps earlier, in the Mission District on Hampshire Street between 24th and 25th, maybe the oldest house that we've got.
So who built this house? I mean,
this house was built by the Treat Brothers, which is T-R-E-A-T, who gave their name to Treat Avenue, I guess formerly known as Treat Street, because Vince Guaraldi wrote a nifty jazz tune about the Treat Street Studios. And this is your standard old pictures and daguerreotype type description here. They were Army veterans. I know that George Treat was an ardent abolitionist. He was a member of the city's first commission of vigilance when perhaps the biggest vigilante...
What is that?
It's the biggest vigilante movement in American history when concerned citizen types took over the city because of the scourge of corruption, and in doing so also executed 8 men, and another man died in jail when he committed suicide during captivity. So not an entirely benign movement. Certainly we could say government can be corrupt, but... as they say, democracy is the worst system except for all the rest. Anyhow, this is what they did. They owned vast tracts of land in San Francisco, where General Hospital is, across the Sunset, which was the outside lands at the time. And they sold it off prudently and were presumably very wealthy. They had finagled deals so railroads would go through their land from San Francisco to San Jose. And, now you remember them or you don't when you see Treat Avenue. Getting to this house, which was John Treat's house, and he was living in it as late as the 1880s, at around which time he died, it went up for sale. It was on sites. Kindly people on the internet alerted us to it, and we looked into it, and that was the story, what might be the oldest house in San Francisco.
What does this house look like? Sale. I mean, is it like an antique? I mean,
You'd never know. George and John Treat were from Maine, and so this looks like what you would have expected to see in mid-19th century Maine. It's described as a clapboard house. It's from the street. It's set back a little. There's a concrete patio there. Steps of the sort you would expect to see in a 1950s motel. The kind where it's slabs of stone with nothing between them.
The steel, mm-hmm. The bar railings, right?
It is, it is a charming house. It is by no means do you look at it and say this is an unusual house. You would never know unless you were doing your research. This is potentially the oldest house in all of San Francisco.
Mm.
It is not a mansion. These men may have owned a lot of land, but a lot of it was on sand. I'm sure that they were not living super duper high off the horse. They did not build themselves a mansion like Charles Crocker or anything like that.
Right.
So that's right. The case. So we wrote a story about how one of the oldest houses in San Francisco was for sale. It's been divided into 4 units. It's being sold as a tenancy in common. And the story was
What is a tenancy in common?
Tenancy in common is like a condo for people who like to risk things. It gets around a lot of laws in San Francisco regarding condo conversions. Essentially, if there are 4 units in the building, it is a jointly owned mortgage, and if one of your neighbors defaults, then you are out of luck.
Hmm.
I think we can curse here on BFF, but I there's no need to. But you are SOL, and that's right, that's one of the reasons it's a risky proposition in San Francisco, where I don't have to tell you about the shortage of affordable and rent controlled housing. There are rules against turning rent controlled apartments into condominiums. One of the ways around that for many years was to go the route of tenancies in common. Which, if you're willing to take the risk, was a way also to buy into the city for less money. And, of course, with that lower price tag comes increased risk. And oftentimes people do shady things to transfer what were apartments into tenancies in common, and that turns out to be what happened here.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so, and now, kind of during the reporting and looking at the story, you found something out. And what did you find out about this house?
Well, neighborhood residents made comments. They knew more than we did because they lived there. And so we followed up on it. And that is also, if you see stories, and you should get a hold of the author, as people did, and I appreciate it. And it turns out that a large number of Latino immigrant and first-generation residents, including 4 generations of a family, a 92-year-old great-grandmother, were Ellis Acted out of the building.
Now, the Ellis Act, I mean, you hear that term all the time. What does that mean?
The Ellis Act is a state law which was ostensibly created so landlords, perhaps elderly landlords, could go out of the landlord business. As in, I'm 90 years old, I don't want to be a landlord anymore. I'm going to use this to get everyone out of the building, and I'm going out of the business of being a landlord. You know, I'm selling the building, I'm moving to Hawaii or to Boca Raton or whatever. That's not what it's used for. It can be used for by serial speculators now, maybe even LLCs that just go through, buy buildings, use the LLC, clear everyone out, rinse and repeat, do it again.
And what do they do with the buildings after they... because what are they allowed to do with the buildings?
Step three, profit.
Right.
You know, I mean, San Francisco, when you've got people who've been living in the building for 40 years, which is the case with some of the people who lived in this building at 1266 and 1268 Hampshire, and it's also 1266A and 1268A upstairs... some of them had been there since 1970. You know, the family in question, the four-generational family that I focus on in this article, had gotten there in 1985, and the eviction proceedings began in 2013. Now, this is one of San Francisco's oldest homes, but you know, I would love to talk to the planning department and Department of Building Inspection because. Really, the building was used like a rented mule. Mostly the last owner before the ones who are selling it now, but others, you know, lots of unwarranted construction, lots of allowing it to become dangerously almost uninhabitable. Many flags for unwarranted construction where people are just building without permits, including work on the foundation, which is not insignificant. You know,
was this happening before the evictions happened, or is that just...
Much of this happened after the evictions happened, when the building was spiffed up in order to make sale. You know, you've got people who are living there, and this is a dilemma for San Francisco that you know, honest people can address, you know, with or without the moral element of evicting 92-year-olds and their great-grandchildren. If you're only getting a limited rental income from the building and it has serious foundational issues, you know, what are you supposed to do? You know, this is something where, you know, people can come up with solutions and maybe the city steps in, provides low-interest loans, etc. In this case, the solution was to kick everyone out and then do unwarranted work on the building, which cheats the city out of money because when you get permits, the permit cost is a fraction of whatever it is you're doing. In this case, it was listed as a $60,000 job, so I think that's a $6,000 permit. And... you know, and then to spiff up the building and then to sell it to somebody for $1.5 million, which is more than twice what it was bought for, you know, in 2008. And now it's being sold for $850,000 a unit, and there are four.
So let's back up. So you went to actually go visit this family in the house, right? I mean, just tell me a little bit about...
I visited them in the house where many of them live.
Oh, right. Exactly. Okay. What happened? Take me through it.
Well, the 94-year-old granny is there, and as is her daughter, her son-in-law, her son, and that's who lives there. And then not far off, two blocks off, are her granddaughter, who's 34, who has two small girls and lives with her partner and her in-laws. And they live on Bryan, and the house I went to was on 22nd. Interestingly enough, on land that was also once owned by the Treat brothers, because they owned that much land. and it's a sad story because, you know, they had I believe a 1-year lease, and it's coming up, and they play, based on what they told me, they pay close to market rate. They're not getting a super duper deal, but you know, when you've got old people like this who are of retirement age, it's going to be a real challenge for them to stay in San Francisco. And they've lived in this neighborhood since 1980. They know all the businesses, you know, they do everything by foot. They just, you know, walk from grocery store to take the bus to home to you know, they live in a neighborhood, you know, in the way that you know, new incoming rich people aspire to, you know, a car-free lifestyle and an intimate you know, relationships with your neighbors and real relationships here. And it's very hard to imagine them staying in the Mission. And when you're 94 years old, you don't want to move.
and what did the old lady tell you?
She was upset. You know, she was upset. And you know, my Spanish is not there, but I did pick up. You know, no me gusta esta casa. You know, this house, the new house she was in, there were steep stairs, so she can't go in and out. She's more or less a prisoner in the house. It's there's no place for her to sit and watch the neighborhood, which is something she used to like to do, and. You know, one really has to worry about stress-related conditions with someone that age. Even the 68-year-old daughter is you know, suffering from stress. This is existential panic here.
Right. So tell me a little bit about who was the guy who who made the eviction, who did all this, and who displaced this family. Tell me a little bit about him.
It's a man named Kuo Chang, and he bought the house from Washington Mutual in 2008, and I didn't get a hold of him, so I'm interested. You know, maybe he has a very compelling story. He is not appear to be a speculator, at least a short-term speculator, because he waited 5 years before initiating evictions. But looking at the record of unwarranted construction, it doesn't seem the place was well kept up at all. And then he initiated the Ellis Act against the family in 2013. There, you know, if you go through the court papers, he wrote, you know, $1,700 checks to a lot of the older relatives, you know, which is, I believe, half of the necessary buyout. And
but surely this guy had some kind of track record of kind of shady behavior or something like that, right?
This happens all the time, but this particular guy had kind of a huge glaring mark in that he pleaded guilty to felony bid rigging in a federal probe that caught up at least 37 or 38 other people.
Now, explain to me what bid rigging is.
In this particular case, you know, when foreclosed properties were bid for, on the city hall steps, so to speak, you know, you've got these distressed properties with, you know, people's misery and all kinds of problems. There was collusion to keep the price down. And that's what he pleaded guilty to. And it does not appear that's what happened in this case, though, because within the federal, the press release and within the actual, you know, plea agreement, it mentioned that this was happening for this gentleman between 2009 and perhaps 2010. He bought the house on Hampshire Street in 2008.
Hmm.
So, you know, you can just kind of put that one into the character file.
So was he big rigging bids on other homes, on real estate?
Essentially, there was collusion among the people who were bidding to to direct the properties to a favored bidder and thereby keep the prices low. It's not unlike what you'll see the accusations of collusion in sports with the free agency market, where there's an agreement to not sign an individual player, as in Colin Kaepernick's case, or just to keep, you know, to not claw over each other to drive the prices high.
Right.
And that's illegal.
Right. And so you said there was a very memorable line in your story, I think, that you said something to the effect of, you know, this is, you know, it's San Francisco's house is host to, you know, sort of San Francisco's oldest story. And what did you mean by that?
No one who lived there knew this, that they were living in what could have been San Francisco's oldest house. They knew it was old because of the antiquated nature of the building. For example, a fellow named Oscar Juarez, who lived downstairs, didn't have any electric in his bathroom at all.
Wow.
You know, and he had to kind of bring in a dangling lamp. So they knew it was an old building, but no one knew that it was potentially the oldest home. So the story of a Latino family, working class, they worked in restaurants. The father, who's 76, is still working out of necessity for a number of reasons. First, fiscal necessity, but also because he doesn't know what to do if he stops. It's his routine. It's his life. And he was evicted. He's, you know, he may be evicted again. And this is, sadly, you know, such an archetypical story in the Mission and in San Francisco. So the line was that San Francisco's oldest home has played host to San Francisco, what has become San Francisco's oldest story of working class, in this case, emigre Latinos being evicted to make way for people who are looking to buy a TIC with, as it put it, a fab location, which is the direct quote, with marble counters and, you know, all the trappings of luxury, you know, in a building that was for many years borderline uninhabitable, dangerous, not well maintained, and large numbers of people lived there out of necessity.
And what do you think? Do you think $850 is a good deal for a house like this?
No. No, I don't. I think that you have to be, you know, I'm a liberal person in some ways, a conservative in others, but I'm very wary of the condo market, and I'm very extremely wary of the TIC market, where people who you don't know could ruin your life by just failing to pay, you know, or even if they're not irresponsible, even if they just, you know, become sick or lose a job or step in front of a muni bus, like suddenly that's your problem in a big way. What's more, it's on your conscience to know that this building was cleansed of its inhabitants so that, you know, money people could buy in. And not only is this happening on this house, of course, it's happening in other houses on the very block. I spoke to a father and son who lived two doors down, and their landlord threatened them with the Ellis Act as well. They also are worried they will fall victim to what's known as a rent eviction. Rent Eviction, I wrote a story for San Francisco Magazine and also followed it for Mission Local about Ann Kihage, who's called the cruelest landlord in San Francisco and has gone through a near unconscionable string of harassment and evictions that, you know, it just boggles the mind. She didn't think that there would be consequences, and the city attorney has successfully sued her and will carry this through to the end. But getting back to Rent Eviction,
sure.
You can... There is a 3-month eviction for the purposes of renovation, but mm-hmm. if you are a dishonest landlord, you just don't let them back in.
Right.
And in this particular case, the people who are often targeted are immigrants or non-proficient English speakers who may not be aware of their rights. And even if you have a right to come back within several months or a year, it's very hard to make do in that time. And if you have to relocate to Modesto or something like that, you're not coming back. So it's tantamount to an eviction.
Do you have any sense of, you know, if this is on an upward trend, rent evictions, or...
I don't have numbers at handy. These are the kinds of things where the city probably keeps numbers, but it's always less exact than you'd wish, right? Mm-hmm. I'm hearing about it more. Right. Certainly, if it's a new trick. I mean, if you're a dishonest person, there are a lot of ways to get away with booting people out of a building. And this is a particularly neat one because, you know, maybe you really are, you know, renovating that apartment, but you're not renovating it, you know, with these people in mind.
Right.
You're renovating it with someone else in mind, and you are just basically starving them until they go away. And if you succeed even 50, 60% of the time in getting rid of them and they don't call a lawyer and they don't make trouble, then you're going to make money.
Do these people stay? I mean, the people who have to leave, do they stay in the city? Do they move, you know, locate? Tell me the name of the family who was involved in the oldest house, who's evicted from the oldest house.
They are the Carcamo family.
The Carcamo family. Now, are most families like them? Do they get to just move down the street?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, while their situation is precarious and while the 34-year-old daughter moved in with her partner and his parents moved in with their in-laws, that's precarious. You know, that's certainly not done and done. And the other wing of the family, Luis, the father, 76, Norma, the mother, 68, her brother, I believe, I've forgotten his name, but also the 94-year-old grandmother, Maria, they're living in a place that the lease is up. And, you know, if they don't find something, you know, they will be forced out. And, you know, hopefully lawyers don't get involved, but the fact of the matter is they have to find something and on the quick.
Right.
And, you know, you've got a 94-year-old involved. You've got a 68-year-old involved. You've got a 76-year-old involved. I'm not sure how old the uncle is. I will admit I failed to ask, but, you know, he's not a young man. And they're living out of a suitcase. You know, it's you know, certainly in San Francisco, there's no shortage of miseries. There's people on the street. You know, there's people shooting up on the train even, you know, but it's just such a damn shame when people work hard all their lives and they're living out of a goddamn suitcase in a home that is about to be, taken away from them.
Now, do you think San Francisco's sort of housing crisis and where, you know, kind of where we're at with, just with prices and displacement, do you think this is kind of ripe for speculation and this kind of exploitation that this guy, Chang, is San Francisco kind of a target now in terms of, you know, these kinds of evictions?
Every developer tells me so. Everybody interested in the real estate market tells me so. The prices are astronomical, don't get me wrong, but, you know, if you were a wealthy speculator, the prices, I was told, aren't as high as you'd think. And so I think this is a big deal when, you know, in the ongoing battle of, we know we need to build more, but how should we build more? We need to build more and make sure people live in those homes. It just wouldn't make sense when you're facing an affordable housing crisis to build luxury homes that people don't live in. And that's a problem.
Do you think that's actually a problem? That, I mean, a big sort of tenet of this so-called "yes in my backyard" YIMBY movement is that, you know, the more we build, you know, the lower prices will get, you know, eventually. I mean, but I'm hearing
I think that there's nothing that people who have done serious work on this like more than being lectured with somebody, you know, with a supply and demand equation out of economics 101, because it's not economics 101. San Francisco's housing situation is complex. We can agree in principle and start from the agreement that we must build more. And we can agree that there's a crisis now. And it was a problem, you know, a decade ago. It's a crisis now. But we also have to look at people like the Carcamo family. You know, I feel for the people who can't move to the city, but I feel more for the people who've made a life here and are losing everything and are not able to adjust because they are too old and don't have resources. So in this particular case, supply and demand only takes you so far because demand is unlimited. And it's not just people, it's offshore money.
Right.
And in this particular case, you have to look at solutions that actually result in housing for people.
Exactly. And so, I mean, I hear anecdotally, and I'm not sure.
I mean, I've looked at the studies. Yeah. The planning department will tell you, several of the candidates for mayor will tell you that studies have been done in which we vastly increased the supply of housing in San Francisco, and the offset in price is minimal. So we should do that. We should aspire to build more. We should take every action to do it. However, we have to know that that is not the magic bullet, that it will take more. You know, and if you are engaged in what is, in essence, trickle-down housing, people like the Carcamo family are going to either not benefit, or the benefits will take so long that they will be not helped. It will take decades. And so, yes, we should certainly plan for things decades in the future, as we do with seawalls and sea level rise and earthquake safety. But we also have to take into account that this is a crisis now for people of limited means now. And to disregard their needs is borderline sociopathic.
Now, just to play devil's advocate, though, I mean, now is, you know, that somebody has to be, okay, for the Carcamo family, obviously, you know, they have elderly people, but just for the, you know, the average sort of low-income person, I mean, do they need to be living in San Francisco? Are there, you know, and is being displaced, you know, the biggest tragedy, you know, that, you know, if they move to, you know, a different part of the Bay Area or somewhere farther away?
That's a loaded question. It gets into social engineering and also deciding who gets to live here.
Right.
We should aspire that people... I mean, it all depends what kind of city you want to have. I mean, Willie Brown, I will not quote often, but I think he actually did get it right when he said that everybody wants San Francisco to be like 2 years before they got there. I think he got that one right. So, you know, the tendency to look backwards through a rose-colored mist is strong. And I made certain also not to do that in the column that we wrote and ran today because, you know, Sara Carcamo, who's 34, was very upfront to point out that when she was growing up, that neighborhood was dangerous.
Right.
You know,
right.
You could get mugged on a regular basis. People right. could die. There was a right. lot of drug and gang activity.
Right.
That has lessened as, you know, we have thrown out babies with the bathwater in that neighborhood. You know, law-abiding citizens who were just trying to make their way, as well as, you know, dangerous gang members have been priced out of the city, you know, and in their place are Audis and Mercedes and fancy cars, and it's a different neighborhood. Now, I don't want to make value judgments about people coming in, but San Francisco is not the place that it was for many years, and San Francisco cannot serve the function that it served for so many years as an emergency valve for the entire nation of America's disaffected people, you know. Gay people came here because this was the place to go when you'd been booted out of your house. Artists came here. Hippies came here. It was a tolerant city. And you can't do that anymore unless you're willing to live in extreme privation or a state of perpetual adolescent penury with 27 roommates, which is not cool when you're in your 30s and want to, like, you know, have kids and whatnot. So it doesn't mean you have to have, you know, a Walnut Creek type lifestyle. There are urban ways to do this, you know? I mean, my wife was brought up in a high-rise apartment in another city. You know, this can be done here, you know, but on the other hand, you know, it's not being done now. San Francisco is very much a Disneyland for adults and a bedroom community for Silicon Valley. And, you know, whether we can do anything about that or whether the train's left the station is, you know, the zillion dollar question.
Now, so we have two more minutes. Joe, give us maybe, you know, a really flash, and this is probably a little bit, you know, more than we can chew for the moment, but what do we do about it? I mean...
That's again, you know, that is a difficult question. I mean, if these questions could be easily solved, they would have been solved. You know, I think that we have to start from the purpose of saying that we have suffering now. We have people who are suffering now. We have a lot, you know, we're facing huge, large-scale evictions, displacement. It's hard to even track because, you know, if the landlord comes and says, here's $3,000, that doesn't show up as an eviction. You know, we're only starting to be able to figure out the buyout numbers. But, you know, on the other hand, there's also compassion fatigue. You know, there's only so much people can do about... there's only so much people want to hear about homeless people, even though it's a story every day and should be a story every day. Yeah. There's only so much you can hear about displacement and gentrification every day. It's an old story. It's almost as old as the Treat Brothers and their racetrack they built and their participation in the vigilante movement and hanging people and all that kind of stuff. It's present, but it feels like it's of another time and it feels hopeless that we can do anything about it. We can do things about it, but it's hard to quote-unquote solve this problem. No one's figured that out. But on the other hand, you can help individual people. You can keep individual people in the city, And you can also build and get new people in the city. There are amenable solutions here. There are ways forward, but, you know,